Welcome to Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to this episode of Physicians Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rachel Giles from Medical Medical Publishers in collaboration with Physicians Weekly. Today's episode features two interviews with an in-depth look at prevention.
The Physicians Weekly Podcast provides thought leader insights on the latest medical news, clinical trial coverage, and advances in medicine and healthcare.
First, we have primary prevention of HIV/AIDS from a community global approach with Dr. Rachel Bagley from the World Health Organization, or the WHO, in Geneva, Switzerland, who has recently published papers in The Lancet HIV and the British Medical Journal. Our second interview is with the Professor Alan Pollack, who's the chair and professor of radiation oncology at the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center in Miami, Florida. He talks us through his recently published trial in The Lancet about a new intervention for secondary prevention of prostate cancer after a prostatectomy. Enjoy listening. Could you just start off by telling me, maybe briefly introduce yourself and talk about the position that WHO takes on HIV prevention?
My name is Rachel Bagley, and I am the unit head for the HIV testing, prevention and populations team at WHO in a department that works on HIV, viral hepatitis and STIs. And of course, WHO takes HIV prevention extremely seriously, has done for many years as part of the general response to HIV. Over the past 4 or 5 years, we've really also looked at HIV alongside viral hepatitis and STIs. And so looking at prevention very much together across those three disease areas.
What are the similarities and differences between those that you can leverage?
Yes, well, that's a really interesting question. It's not a homogeneous response. And looking across populations, many populations who are vulnerable to HIV or who have HIV are also vulnerable or have STIs. So there are a lot of opportunities there for preventing and treating STIs. For viral hepatitis, it's much more of a mixed picture because the epidemiology of viral hepatitis, hepatitis B and C, is very different in populations and across geographies. So, for example, hepatitis C, the prevalence of hepatitis C and the incidence of hepatitis C is high amongst people who inject drugs and also in some people who are gay or bisexual men or other men who have sex with men. Hepatitis B is much more geographically focused in some areas. And so, therefore, when we're looking at hepatitis B integration, we really focus on those areas that have high hepatitis B prevalence and incidence. And there, one of the areas for looking at prevention is in prevention of mother-to-child transmission. So we've had for decades prevention of HIV from mothers to children, vertical transmission, as a mainstay of the response to HIV. And now WHO is really looking at what we call triple elimination, so looking at HIV, hepatitis B and syphilis, and have much greater impact if one addresses these three infections together.
Really interesting. And we've seen a lot of developments happening in the last 2 decades about pre-exposure prophylaxis for some of these viruses. Could you please talk about that briefly and how your work on that has been altered, I guess, or has been developed?
It's a really exciting field. And as you say, it's more than a decade that WHO has been working on pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, as it's commonly known. You know, the first trial, IPREX, was amongst men who have sex with men. And the results came out then in about 2011. And WHO really reacted quickly. We developed guidelines on implementation science, you know, really to push that for communities other than MSM. And then as more information and results became available from other population groups, we were able to make broader recommendations. And these recommendations have evolved over time as we have more information. So the oral PrEP push from WHO, the recommendations from WHO for anyone at substantial HIV risk were released in about 2015. And there's been a rapid scale up of countries that have adopted oral PrEP guidance since then, and a gradual increase in people accessing oral PrEP. And it's particularly exciting that over the past couple of years, particularly in Eastern Southern Africa, but there's been a significant increase in PrEP projects. The other exciting thing about oral PrEP is that we can now think of different ways to deliver it for people so that people have much more choice about where they might have services. And this was really accelerated through COVID. when people couldn't go to clinics, we had to be much more flexible about delivering PrEP. And there's some fantastic examples from Asia, particularly, and also anywhere that's delivering PrEP. But they're really, you know, Vietnam has been an absolute champion of this, supporting PrEP delivery with, in a hybrid way, with online services, with community pickup, and using self-testing, because people on PrEP should test for HIV every 3 months, and self-testing can be some way to decrease that clinical contact. So a couple of weeks ago, we released what we call our differentiated and simplified PrEP delivery. And that really gives lots of examples of how we can make PrEP much more available in communities. And there are exciting projects as well that are thinking about or starting to deliver PrEP through pharmacies, again, with self-testing, and making a much more normalised approach to HIV prevention. The other thing that we've learned is PrEP's not for life, and we have to be very flexible about how people want to use it. People can start and stop and restart, and as long as they have all that information about how to test for HIV, this can fit very much into people's lives. And then for men, we recommend also offering what's called the event-driven PrEP. It's a 2-1-1 to take two tablets before sex and then one tablet after and one, you know, 12 hours after that. So we have guidelines on that. And again, that's a really nice option for people who prefer to just take PrEP around their sexual lives.
Could you talk about that a bit more?
Of course, you know, the really big news is the long-acting PrEP, long-acting cabotegravir, which is an intramuscular injection every 8 weeks. And it's been a very exciting time. The two big trials, HPTN-083, amongst men have sex with men and transgender women, and HPTN-084 among women in Eastern Southern Africa, their results were really stunning. These will take a daily or event-driven pill. And we also have the dapivirine vaginal ring, which is another option for women who would like a very much a woman-controlled product. So the dapivirine vaginal ring is a ring which has dapivirine, is impregnated with dapivirine, which is released slowly over a month. And the efficacy of this product is difficult to establish exactly what the efficacy is, because in the trials, the results weren't as stunning as they were for cabotegravir. So in the trials, these were done several years ago, there were two trials. And when one looked at the results from those trials, those randomized controlled trials, the efficacy was estimated to be around 30%. However, this was what we call on an attention to treat basis. And many women didn't use the vaginal ring or didn't use it in a consistent way. So when the open label extension occurred after these trials, efficacy was much higher, but still not as high as with oral PrEP or with the cabotegravir injection. That being said, the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, approved dapivirine vaginal ring as an additional option for women. And countries have started to, in particularly in Eastern Southern Africa, have started to think about including this. And South Africa now has regulatory approval, as do several other countries. I think it's really critical to remember here that we have to listen to the voices of women about what choices they want. And I think women are the right people to make these decisions. And so they have to balance what they want with that knowledge that perhaps the dapivirine vaginal ring isn't quite as efficacious as oral PrEP or cabotegravir, but it may be the choice that they want. And they may want to switch between products for different times in their life. So it's great. It's all about choice. It's all about being people-centered and listening to communities to see what they want and how they want it delivered.
Excellent. And what about some of the access issues? I know that you recently published something about nurse-supplied PrEP. Could you talk about that and how some of the obstacles can be perhaps addressed with creative solutions?
Absolutely. You know, if we're going to get prevention products really out into communities, we must make them simpler and we must broaden people who can deliver and support use. And many countries already have nurse-led PrEP services. And this is really commonplace in Southern and Eastern Africa. But other countries are sort of stricter and require physician-led services. And we really want to push for nurse-led services and also for community support. So community healthcare workers, peer supporters, lay providers, to really offer that support to help with the demand creation, with help with answering questions about PrEP choices, and then to support people to continue to switch to start and stop safely. So it's a kind of team event, but we want to take things out of specialist clinics and make them much more available in different community sites. And that's why also pharmacy-led may be an option, particularly for men and other groups who prefer a sort of more 24/7 type service.
Wonderful. So my last question is, looking at the horizon, the scope of the horizon, what's coming up? What's around the corner?
So I think there are two things, and I just want to mention one thing which is getting a lot of traction at the moment, is the really increasing knowledge that people on treatment who are successfully on treatment and are virally suppressed don't transmit HIV. And we really need to get that message out there, because that's also a huge prevention option for couples where one person has HIV, or for people who have HIV, they're not going to be a risk to partners if they're on treatment. So that's a really positive message that we need communities to understand and the healthcare providers to understand. There are other products that are in the pipeline. And of course, there's a trial of another injectable antiretroviral that is going through at the moment. And there are broadly neutralizing antibodies, which are really at an early stage. And there are many other sort of early stage products. So it's a really interesting pipeline. But we must remember, we have good products now. You know, we do have these PrEP choices. We must really make sure that, you know, at the moment, access isn't great. Access is good for oral PrEP, but it's really not great. And we must really try and expand that access and make that easier. We're absolutely at the beginning with cabotegravir. It's only been approved at the moment in the US. It's now being approved in Australia. But we need to really support low and middle income countries to approve. And we need a price that's going to be affordable for low and middle income countries. And that's all being negotiated at the moment. So we need to really push for a price that is affordable for low and middle income countries. But also, we mustn't forget condoms. They're great. The people have really gone off the boil with condoms. They're effective against HIV. They're effective against STIs. They're effective against hepatitis. They're effective against unplanned pregnancies. So they're a great addition. And again, we must also allow more exciting condom programs to really invigorate those for the multiple benefits they have. Again, it's all about choice. All about choice and listening to communities to understand what they want and how they want it delivered.
Thank you so much, Dr. Badalese.
That's great, Rachel.
So our next interview is with Professor Alan Pollack, who is the chair and professor of radiation oncology at the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center in Miami. So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Pollack. Can you tell me about your study that is published in Lancet? What was the unmet need that you were trying to address?
The time this study was devised, which was around 2005 when it got an official number, there were no data on the combination of using hormone therapy or androgen deprivation therapy with standard prostate tumor bed treatment. So this prostate bed, meaning after surgical resection of the prostate and then having a rising PSA afterwards. So these would be patients who would have be a candidate for salvage radiotherapy for a rising PSA after prostatectomy. We had lots of data at that time regarding the use of androgen deprivation therapy in combination with radiation for men who had a prostate and who were treated primarily. But we didn't have any data on men treated in the salvage setting after a prostatectomy for a rising PSA. So that was one of the arms. There were three arms in the study. One was prostate bed radiotherapy alone. This is the surgical bed standard treatment versus prostate bed radiotherapy plus short-term androgen deprivation therapy, hormone therapy, for 4 to 6 months. There was a third arm included as well, because there was some evidence at the time that treating the pelvic lymph nodes, so expanding the field to include the pelvic lymph nodes, would provide additional benefit. The hypothesis of this trial was that there would be an incremental benefit going from the addition of androgen deprivation therapy to prostate bed radiotherapy, and that this would result in a 10% improvement in outcome, and that the addition of pelvic lymph node treatment would result in an additional benefit of 10%. So a total of 20% as compared to the control arm, which was prostate bed radiotherapy alone.
Well, that was the hypothesis. What were the findings?
The findings were that there was an incremental benefit for each of the additional treatments, treatment intensification, if you will, going from prostate bed only to adding androgen deprivation therapy and the further addition of pelvic lymph node treatment. We used an endpoint of what we call Nader plus 2, which is a common endpoint that is used for men who have a prostate, but was not previously used in the setting of men who've had their prostates removed and had a rising PSA. The rationale for using that endpoint is that it correlated very strongly in a preliminary study with clinical failure. And we anticipated that that endpoint would be very predictive of ultimately distant metastasis and perhaps survival. That endpoint was approved by the National Cancer Institute as a reasonable endpoint to use, as opposed to standard biochemical failure, which is defined as 0.2 or 0.4 and rising. And this is a stronger endpoint than that. The hypothesis in the trial was that the Nader plus 2 failure rate, along with any other failure, would be around 70%. In fact, it was 71%, and we hypothesized a 10% improvement or reduction in failure with the addition of androgen deprivation therapy, and that went to 81%, and another 10% with the addition of pelvic lymph node treatment, and that went to 87%. The results were pretty close to what was anticipated using the 5-year freedom from progression endpoint that was the primary endpoint.
The implications are quite large. Could you please describe to the physician colleagues that are listening to this how this might impact the treatment options that are available for patients in the near future?
The results from this study do have significant clinical implications. Men who have a rising PSA have higher biochemical failure rates than the Nader plus 2 definition, and that failure does end up resulting in interventions such as a secondary androgen deprivation therapy with the further rise in PSA. So anything we can do to limit failure in this population would be beneficial. The morbidity of the treatment is much less than the morbidity of having a recurrence and ending up on permanent androgen deprivation therapy. We also attempted in the study to identify factors that predicted for a better outcome using androgen deprivation therapy. So we took the median cut point of PSA, which was 0.35, and we looked at patients who had lower PSAs before enrolling and being treated on the study versus those that had the higher PSAs. We found that all patients benefited from androgen deprivation therapy. There's been a considerable amount of debate in terms of who should get the androgen deprivation therapy. The results from our study indicate that all the patients would benefit, and we had patients with PSAs as low as 0.1 going up to less than 2.0. In terms of the benefit of androgen deprivation therapy, we found that those with PSAs above the median at 0.35 were the ones that benefited the most. That isn't to say that there aren't some patients with PSAs below 0.35 that wouldn't benefit from the addition of androgen deprivation therapy. You have to look at the other risk factors besides PSA, but PSA is one of the stronger factors. Somebody with a lot of high-risk features that was caught early with a PSA below 0.5 is likely to benefit from androgen deprivation therapy as well. To summarize, the standard of care for the treatment of men with a rising PSA post-prostatectomy is shifting to the use of androgen deprivation therapy for virtually all men, and the treatment of the pelvic lymph nodes should be strongly considered, especially if the PSA is above 0.35.
Yeah, that's very clear. Thank you so much for your time.
Great.
That's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.